dear friend, just a few words to start with in case anybody does not have from this year a copy of the bullet points. These are the bullet points from Makuto 2004, which were put together by one of you. So you see, you can take the incomplete, inadequate, unpolished, unready material of the Sanatavani and do the same thing. You can make it your own. This is some bullet points, and those of you from last year who may wish to also have a copy, because it's a very useful tool for taking away and maybe helping other people know what is in this material, are very welcome to contact the Youth Coordinating Committee members, and you can pay for your own copies. And this is for anyone from this year, of course, who didn't get their copy. Also, just to double check, has everybody got the sentence for today? Please put your hands up if you didn't have it. There's a couple of more at the back. Shamsi Jana, would you mind giving me a wave at maybe 20 past? Thank you. Because we have learned since yesterday the importance of being able to control time so that we're able to understand the periods of time that we have at our disposal and achieve the goals that are necessary within the time allocated to us. And sometimes we need to be reminded by a few notes about epochs and cycles about exactly where we are. So I'm very grateful to have a local representative here to tell me how many cycles I've got left. So with that last wave, I'll be able to tell you. I'll be able to keep it under control. I wanted to just mention something, because a member of the group, to whom I shall be forever, ever grateful, came to me yesterday and said, very frankly, she said, you know, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but I didn't really get what you were talking about. She said, what exactly are you doing? She said, it's very nice, you know, hearing about these sentences and stuff, but why are you doing this? What's it for? And I suddenly thought to myself, in fact, I thought all night, what am I doing? I mean, we have heard Mr. Nachtavani say not once and not twice, but several times, that there were Baha'is in the early days of the faith. Of course, this was in Persia. This wasn't in the advanced countries of the West, who didn't completely grasp the meaning of world order, as was mentioned in the Kitab Ardas by Baha'u'llah, and had this illusion that he was referring to the order of words on the page instead of world order. Now, here I am inviting you to look at the word order of words on the page. In the fifth epoch of the formative age, of the formative age, where am I? I've completely missed the boat here. And then I also thought to myself that, you know, all of this stuff I've been saying since yesterday about such simultaneous processes, this is just the murmur of syllables and sounds. I'm inviting you to get drunk on the words. Half of you don't know what I'm saying. One of the friends said to me yesterday, she said, you know, I have no trouble with Mr. Nachtavani's talks. I have no trouble with Mrs. Nachtavani. I understand everything they say. But really, I have a lot of trouble with you. So I have to apologize, because I'm clearly doing something very wrong here. I'm asking you to look at the wrong things. But it did occur to me that perhaps in my assumption that we had had last year and now we're continuing, I perhaps didn't sum up enough some of the points that we had made last year about why we are looking at these sentences, how we are looking at them. I would, of course, invite you to just cast a brief glance. Don't take too much time, because your time should be spent studying the material of this course. And tomorrow, I'm sure you're going to be told, tomorrow is talk number 4 in Roman numerals. You have to be prepared to have read all that. So you've got today through the study period until tomorrow to be prepared for Mr. Nakhchivani's talk on Tuesday. Please don't take any time at all to just cast a cursory glance at the paragraph I've given you in The Art of Reading. But just in case you happen to have a free second, you might take a look at that to help you understand why I'm doing this. Because if you remember last year, those of you that were here, one of the things we discovered that we all felt in common, especially those of us who do not come to the language of Shoghi Effendi from an English background, and even those of us who do have English as our so-called mother tongue, it's very difficult to read the language of Shoghi Effendi, isn't it? Really, sometimes you look at these sentences, I mean, just take a look at the sentence from yesterday. Look at the sentence from today. Excuse me, this is one sentence. Do you realize that? I've spread it out on a page, but it is one sentence. To even just begin reading these sentences, you have to take a very deep breath, fill your lungs with oxygen, and go for it. And you don't stop, you don't stop, you don't stop till you get to the bottom of the page. My God, it takes so much energy. Not only energy, it takes courage. It takes a certain kind of courage that I want to talk about in our sentence today. It takes a kind of heroic courage to read the language of Shoghi Effendi. He's making heroes of us. And the reason I want us to look at those sentences is because in the space of one sentence, Shoghi Effendi puts the world order in one sentence. And the reason you can see the world order in the order of his words is the reason why his language, even if he is not the exemplar, and in his modesty and humility, does not place himself in that rank, as Mr. Nakhchivani was telling us, of Baha'u'llah, Abdu'l-Baha, and the Bab, who are our exemplars of perfection. Nevertheless, he chose to translate the immortal words of the founders of our faith into English, which is of such a caliber and of such a beauty that truly there is a great deal we can learn from the example of his English. We can discover in a single sentence that vision he gives us that is going to carry us through all these epochs and cycles to the end of this dispensation. He has an ability in a single sentence to give us a moral vision of the world. He's inviting us to engage with him in that exercise of moral imagination. This is an extraordinary capacity. You know, those of us who are students in the humanities know very well that the power of imagination is something that we have to be studying in all the arts, in all the forms of literary expression. We know very well that the imagination is something that has been exercised over and over again through all of our great cultures in Europe. It has found itself expressed in theatre, in poetry, and one of the joys of inviting you to come and bring your culture at the Akuto courses for this wonderful beginning of the cultural night is to hear the beauty of your poetry, your drama, your epics, your theatre, expressed in your native language, your mother tongue. Hear that beautiful music of all the different languages of Europe being expressed. This is the expression of the imagination of this continent that traverses two good millennia. We have the poetry going way back to the earliest centuries of Christendom in this continent. Now, what Shoghi Effendi is giving us is something unique, because his imagination is not only stirring, as I pointed out to you, the metaphorical levels of the mind, the beauty of the language itself leading to the metaphors, leading to the archetypes. It's going beyond that to a spiritual vision. And in his language, he's giving us the tools very systematic tools based on the syntax and the command of vocabulary of one particular language that he has chosen amongst the rest because of its flexibility at this time, because of its pliability, its elasticity. He had the choice, you know, because he was educated in French, of using the beauty of the French language. He chose to use English. And I think it's because English allows itself to be stretched like chewing gum in all kinds of directions, whereas French is much more formal. I discovered when going to France to live that, in fact, it's only nominally a country that calls itself Catholic, you know. The real religion of France is its language. And you mustn't contaminate the beauty of that language. There is no question, it is a most remarkably beautiful language. But for the purposes of a world order, the establishment of a world civilization that is going to be applicable to people from a multitude of different cultures and different backgrounds, for some reason known only in the mysterious knowledge of God, at this particular point in the many cycles and epochs to come of this dispensation, English was considered a befitting tool and was given as a tool in the hands of Shoghi Effendi to use for our benefit. So we're being invited by him to look at those sentences he uses as examples. Maybe we don't, in respect of him, look at his own life necessarily as an example, but let us at least look at the use of the English language and see what we can learn from that use of the language, what it tells us about the world order. Now, I didn't have time yesterday to really go to the end of the sentence. And if you remember, the main sentence of yesterday brought us to the word aspects. Just flip over for a second and take a look at that. All these processes, which seem to be working reciprocally and continuously with one another, are but aspects, he says, of a greater plan. Now, you remember that greater plan is that great game in which Baha'u'llah moves the pawns. Its source is God. Its author is Baha'u'llah. And I wanted to emphasize for a minute, just for 2 seconds, that yesterday's sentence was drawing your attention to the fact that the apparent differences of rise and fall, of integration and disintegration, and those reactions, they are all simply seen in this sentence as aspects of one thing. They appear to be contradictory, but they are indivisibly part of one process, one greater plan. And it's important to see that unity at the core of that sentence, which is so manifestly clear in the way that I tried to show you on the page. It brings your attention back to that pivotal point of oneness. Now, when you look at today's sentence, let's take a look at it for a minute. I'm sorry there is no time to first just read it so that you don't see it laid out like this. But just imagine it as a simple sentence written flowing in one line after the other, because the beauty of it is to discover that this is the shape of it after time. So if I quickly read it to you, you get some idea of that single sentence. Putting on the armor of his love, firmly buckling on the shield of his mighty covenant, mounted on the steed of steadfastness, holding aloft the lance of the word of the Lord of hosts, and with unquestioning reliance on his promises as the best provision for their journey, let them set their faces towards those fields that still remain unexplored and direct their steps to those goals that are as yet unattained, assured that he who has led them to achieve such triumphs and to store up such prizes in his kingdom will continue to assist them in enriching their spiritual birthright to a degree that no finite mind can imagine or human heart perceive. You know, I sometimes teach in my spare time at colleges and things where people write. And very often they write and they don't use a main sentence. So, for example, they would write, putting on the armor of his love, firmly buckling on the shield of his mighty covenant, mounted on the steed of steadfastness, holding aloft the lance of the word of the Lord of hosts, and with unquestioning reliance on his promises as the best provision of their journey. And you say, excuse me? So? And then what? And then what? We very often write without saying what it is we're actually talking about. That whole first clause that I read you there, which is made up of different phrases, is a preparation for the main clause, for the main sentence that we're looking at. I've written the main sentence to make it easier for you in capital letters. What Shoghi Effendi is actually saying here, let's just jump. Let's not worry about putting on our armor for a minute. Let's just get on with it. What is he actually asking us to do? He's saying, let them set their faces and direct their steps. That's his instruction. And he's giving it to us in such a way that it is, permit them to, allow them to. It's not even, set your faces and direct your steps. He's not telling us to do it. He's doing it in the third person. He's saying, may you be able to set your faces and direct your steps. He's doing it almost as an appeal. He's saying, please, God, allow them to set their faces and direct their steps. That is at the heart of that sentence, is a prayer. Oh God, let them set their faces and direct their steps. Now, setting your face is an interesting thing. You know, in this cause we have several places where we are told to set our faces. What does it actually mean? I set my face. I turn. I draw my whole attention to that point. We're doing it in the obligatory prayers, aren't we? We're asked to stand and await the good pleasure of God, turning to the east, to the right and to the left. We face the Qibla. We set our faces towards. We direct our faces first, our gaze, our attention, the focus of our attention. We look somewhere. You know, we've been given, as the human race, eyes in front of our heads. Curiously enough. Unlike cats and so forth, or birds rather, you know, we're actually given the opportunity to look ahead of us. Interesting. To get a sense of the future that we're walking towards. Of course, this is a debatable advantage. There are some people who would say that it might be better to have eyes at the back of our heads, but that's another issue. The fact is that spiritually speaking, having eyes in the front of your head is very significant. Because it allows you, before you even take a single step, to show that that's your intention. And we often discover, don't we, that although it takes a long time to go on that long route of relativity towards perfection, which we never attain, we would never even be able to take the first step if we didn't first direct our eyes to that point. That's the very first inner step that we take, is to decide that is where I'm going to go towards. And Shoghi Effendi makes that the first part of his prayer. Let them set their faces. The face is also something very important in the faith, isn't it? I remember so many times Mr. Nashavani has said that there were four qualities that Baha'u'llah loved so much to see in the friends. Now, I'm going to get them all mixed up because I have such a porous memory. Determination to reach a goal. Perseverance, in other words. Courage. I was going to get to the smiling face at the end. Give me the other one first. what you... Yes, yes, that's determination and persistence. Courage in the enterprise. What was the third one? A fairness of judgment. The ability to see with your own eyes and judge with your own conscience. That was the third one. May have been the first one. But certainly one of the four, and the one I wanted to end with, is a radiant, smiling countenance. Let them set their faces. And remember, it says in those beautiful writings of Baha'u'llah, through them the countenance of the world shall be wreathed in smiles. So by your setting your face, you get the reciprocity. You create smiles in the other. You create joy in the faces of those around you. Just set your face in that right direction and you will begin already to get a response. Do you see how much there is in just the business of setting your face? And that's just the first part of that main sentence. The second part, of course, is the part related to action. Because as soon as you begin the inward act, you complete it with the outward one and direct their steps. But perhaps I shouldn't get too close to the action before I go back to that very disturbing process of preparation. Because, you know, we can't actually set our faces. We can't actually direct our steps until we prepare ourselves to set our faces and direct our steps. And that's the reason Shoghi Effendi gives us this whole long, look at it, how many? 5 phrases, clauses that he gives us with which, just even in the act of reading, he forces us to prepare ourselves to set our faces. And how does he ask us to do this? I wanted to emphasize the way that first clause does not live on its own. It is not the main sentence. It does not stand alone, because everything, if you look at it, depends on those dangling participles. Putting, buckling, mounted on, holding aloft, with unquestioned reliance as the best provision, etc. These are, you know, normally when you're an English teacher, you tell people, don't use participles, present participles, because they're weak. Don't use them at the end of towards the end of a sentence, certainly, because they tend to be weak. Don't use them in poetry. They make it all sound rather ing-ing-ing-ing-ing-ing-ing-ing-ing, you know. Try to avoid them. Now, what Shoghi Effendi has done, he's taken that seemingly weak present participle, which means this is an action which is continually in process. There is no end to it. That's the reason why, syntactically, you have to be careful where you use that word, because if you're not careful, a word which sort of has no beginning and kind of has no end is a bit floppy, you know, that kind of word. And if you're not careful with your use of it, it ends up making your sentence very sort of wishy-washy. Putting, when did I start doing the putting? When did I end doing the putting? But in this context, what Shoghi Effendi is exactly using it for is to tell us there is no end to your putting on the armor of his love. Don't imagine that you'll finish buckling on the shield of his mighty covenant. Don't think that if you've once mounted on the steed, that's enough. I did it, you know, last year in Akuto. That'll do. I don't need to keep on mounting on the steed. Gosh, one gets tired going up on that stirrup all the time. This is a continuous process. It's exactly what Mr. Natavani was telling us. If we, in fact, look at what those things are that we are putting on, buckling on, holding aloft, each one of those are the spiritual qualities essential to the individual. Now, he spoke to us this morning about detachment, about the need to work on ourselves, to achieve that ideal of severance that we will never achieve, in fact. That's one of those. He told us about the need to be firm in the covenant. This is something we have to be continually working on. Isn't that what firmly buckling on the shield of his mighty covenant is? It's working on our steadfastness. It's working on our firmness to the covenant. the shield of his love, the armor of his love. He also spoke about the need for us to be working continuously. How many times in so many of the tablets of the Divine Plan, Abdu'l-Bahá keeps re-emphasizing the importance in individual life of love, of working on harmony, of unity, of concord. That is what we are doing when we are putting on the armor of his love. We are working on all of these elements that are in those first five phrases and clauses that Shoghi Effendi has given us in the sentence. And with unquestioning reliance on his promises. Surely that's what he meant by trust. Not only faith, but also trust that leads us to action. A trust that gives us the confidence to take the first step. It's only when we have done all those things, and not when we've done it. Okay, now I've done it, so now I'm ready, now I can go. No, it's been continuously in the process of doing it. You know, in today's talk, I was so struck by the fact, as you know, we're looking at the twin themes of the guardianship and the tablets of the Divine Plan, how Mr. Nakhchivani was trying to emphasize for us the importance placed by Shoghi Effendi not only on propagation and teaching, but also on administration. Not only on the work of the administrative order, but also on the work of teaching. How these two processes have to be continuously in action. He said to us yesterday, or was it this morning, he said, we cannot have a balanced Baha'i life without having these twin processes at work. Now just imagine for yourselves for a minute, that knight in shining armor that we all are, that great hero of the cause that has been summoned to not only read a sentence of Shoghi Effendi without taking a breath, but actually serve his cause. Not only be able to understand what his English is about, but realize it's about the world order in his order of words. That hero, he gets ready. He decides he's going to put on his armor. Nice armor, shiny armor, works on it there. Puts on the helmet. He gets ready with his shield. Bit heavy, but, you know, covenant's a bit heavy sometimes. Get ready. He gets onto his steed. You know, I'm not much of a horsewoman. In fact, the first and last time I ever sat on a horse, it sneezed. And that was the end of my attempt to mount on the steed of steadfastness. So I get there, and I finally lift up the lance. Now, you know, those of you who come from Spain, how I would have loved to have heard some of the work of Don Quixote. Oh, there he is. See him? That grand hero. Lopsided a bit with his lance, but there he's got his lance. And then he pauses for a minute, and he looks at the mirror. Not bad. Got my helmet straight. I'm holding my shield in the right position. Wouldn't mind having somebody take a picture of me like this. Getting ready for the camera. Now, that's the whole point here. If that is the way we are going to acquire our individual virtues or work on our personal lives or try to reach to that level of detachment which will make it possible for us to finally turn our faces, there's no use for it. Everything that Mr. Nakhchivani was telling us this morning was, if you are going to work on yourself, it's in order to be ready for action. If you are going to be able to act, you had better work on yourself. There is no point, my dear friends, in our getting ready to be heroes if it's just to stand in our dressing rooms and look at ourselves dressed in our armor. The whole purpose of it is so that we set our faces and direct our steps. It is all in preparation for the main part of that sentence. And without that preparation, we would not be able to understand the rest of the sentence. That's why we're using Shoghi Effendi's single sentences to understand the very process that he wants us to follow in achieving the world order of Baha'u'llah. So here we finally come to let them set their faces. Am I running out of time? Still got there. Good. Got my cycles a little bit better this time, haven't I? Let them set their faces. Where? Towards those fields that still remain unexplored. And direct their steps. Where? To those goals that are as yet unattained. There's something very interesting that happens in this sentence. The whole attention and focus of the reader is being turned away from himself outward. Stop looking at the mirror, at your armor, at your helmet, at your lance. Don't preoccupy yourself like a monk in a monastery about working on your motives forever and ever and ever. Are you really detached? Are you really pure at heart? Is it possible that you could have had ulterior motives in this? Well, maybe you'd better go back into the closet and work on your armor a bit more. Everything is pushing you out there. And where is it asking you to face? And where is it asking you to go? Look at those phrases. Towards those fields that still remain unexplored. In other words, there is always the unknown ahead of you. There is always the undefined around you. And that is why it takes courage to read his sentences and to be this kind of a hero. Because he doesn't want us to do the comfortable things that we know about. He doesn't say, direct your steps to do exactly what you did last year in Akuto, so that you feel nice and safe because you did this before, didn't you? Yeah, you know about this. He's telling you to do something new. He's saying this year it's different. And next year it will be new again. And with every day that you live, there has to be yet another field unexplored that you have the courage to enter. And another region, another goal that you have not yet attained. Go there. Now, we're going to hear in the course of this week how Shoghi Effendi literally gave fields, geographic fields to the friends, which had never been attained, had never been explored by any Baha'is before. They were what he called virgin territories, where there were no Baha'is. And we will be talking about that with Mr. Nachavani in the course of this week. I want you to remember the sentence, because it not only applies, of course, to those geographical spaces and places, it applies to a myriad other ways in which we are being invited to be heroes. When Mr. Nachavani was telling us this morning about our fear of teaching, it's because we don't want to make that risk of going into that unexplored place. We chose tasks, you know, for the workshops just to help us accustom ourselves to the idea of stepping into those regions and places that are unexplored, standing there all naked and alone in front of a professor and having to defend the faith. Those are the goals, those are the regions, those are the places that we have to have the courage to face. To hear someone attack the faith and be willing to stand there, not looking and cringing backward, but confident. Now, we will go on and see how we will be able to go into those regions. Because the whole of the rest of that clause, starting with the italic, assured. Syntactically, what that is telling you how. It is an adverbial clause of manner. And it's telling you how you set your faces and direct your steps. It's not just telling you where you turn your face and to what you direct your steps. It's telling you how you do it. And it's very interesting that Shoghi Effendi gives us a very solid clause there. It's no dangling participle. It's assured. Now that's a past participle. And a past participle in English which ends in ED is a much more solid framework on which to stand. These are all sort of subjective things, but they are related to English grammar. And if you want to explore the idea further, you have to go back into the Latin, and I don't have time for all of that. But it's very interesting that that whole ending there assured that he who has led them will continue to assist them. That's the final clause of that sentence. It's a clause because it contains within itself that assured that he will continue to assist them. That means there's a clause there, there is a solid verb. And what is the verb of that clause? It's will continue. Assured that he will continue. He, and you find out who has led them, and then you understand more about where he has led them to achieve such triumphs and store up such prizes in his kingdom. That is all part of where he has led them. So it's a subordinate clause within, sorry, phrase, because there's no verb in that one. There's only the infinitive. Do you see? To achieve and to store up is very different from will continue. When it's only the infinitive, it's not a present verb or a past verb which can stand on its own feet. And so it's no longer just, it's no longer a clause, it's just a phrase in English. That's what we call it. It's a subordinate phrase. And that subordinate phrase is telling us where or what, to who has led them to do what. Okay? In brief. But the main clause there, which is helping us understand he who has led them, etc., it's he will continue. And everything in that clause is fixed on the future tense. He will continue. And it's balanced by that earlier phrase, he who has led them in the past will continue to assist them. So it's a wonderfully balanced promise there. Everything hanging on that word assured. Assured, which means being certain, being absolutely confident that he who has led them to achieve, etc., will continue to assist them in enriching. Now, it's interesting that that last phrase, in enriching their spiritual birthright to a degree that no finite mind, etc., it reminds us, doesn't it, of those first participles that we began the sentence with. We began, remember, putting on, buckling on, holding aloft. By the time we get to the end, and he has assured us that what he's done in the past will continue to be there for us in the future, he will continue to assist them to do what? In enriching. In other words, he is promising in this sentence, that he will continue to assist us to continue enriching. In other words, that story of perpetual development is still not over. By the time we get to the end of the sentence, we're ready, my dears, to begin reading it again. Because how do we enrich our spiritual birthright? Guess what? It's by putting on that armor. It's by buckling on that shield. It's the merry-go-round. We're back to square one, except it's not square one. It's progressive. We're continuing onward. By the time we get to the end of that first reading of the sentence, we may be ready to start reading it again at a deeper level. I want to stop a minute and ask you which was the word that you had difficulty with, and which was the word you might have chosen, and see whether it's the same one that I chose. Any ideas? You need to maybe take a look at that sentence for 2 seconds. I'll read it for you again. Putting on the armor. You know, there are many words that we do know. But then I'm asking you to think of a word which is a little bit uncertain in your minds, okay? Putting on the armor of his love. Firmly buckling on the shield of his mighty covenant. Mounted on the steed of steadfastness, holding aloft the lance of the word of the Lord of hosts, and with unquestioning reliance on his promises as the best provision for their journey, Let them set their faces towards those fields that still remain unexplored and direct their steps to those goals that are as yet unattained, assured that he who has led them to achieve such triumphs and to store up such prizes in his kingdom will continue to assist them in enriching their spiritual birthright to a degree that no finite mind can imagine or human heart perceive. I don't know about you, but the word that I thought would be interesting to double check was that word, birthright. Are there any other words that you want to double check while we're still at it? You had some suggestions? Now, what it refers to will become clearer if we double check what it means. And when I was looking for those words for you, and this is something you can double check, go to the dictionary, to the Roger's Thesaurus, and see all the different ways you can understand this word. Yes?
Can we double
check the word buckling? Buckling. Buckling on. Do you want me to do your dirty work for you, or do you want to take that and work with it yourself? You know, somebody came to me at the end of yesterday with a whole list of words he didn't understand. I started giving him meanings, and then I thought, what am I doing? I'm really being stupid here. I mustn't tell him what these words mean. He's got a mind. He can find out for himself. If you find words you don't understand, you've got every opportunity to look them up. Check them out. Ask other people in the group, maybe, when you're working this afternoon. If you really can't find out at the end of this week, come to me and I'll be your Roger's Thesaurus. But I have to be able to add that at the end of my CV, that I have served as the dictionary of somebody. That could be quite a useful attribute. But I think you might be able to find dictionaries for yourselves. Buckling on is a very interesting word. It's a good word, buckle. It's an onomatopoeic word that might help you understand buckle, figure out what it means, even in the sound. But you can double check it with me at the end of the week if you still don't know. I looked up birthright because, in fact, it's a word that's going to come up more than once. So in another of the sentences that we're going to read together this week, you will hear that same word. So I chose it for you because it had sufficient ambiguity in it to work in two directions. And these are the ways in which I defined it for you. Birthright can either mean inheritance, heritage, patrimony, bequeathal, heirloom, legacy. Or, in another direction, it could mean your prerogatives, your privileges, your appurtenances, your presumptive rights, the claims you make, what is your due. Now, of course, there are congruities there in those two words. I want you to ask yourselves now, which of the two circles of meaning do you think is most applicable in this sentence? Do you think so? Enriching their spiritual prerogatives. Enriching their spiritual rights. Does that sound right? Enriching their spiritual claims. Let's look at the first one. You're doing all this. You're putting on your armor. You're buckling on your shield. You're getting mounted on that steed. You're raising aloft the word of the Lord of hosts. You're summoning up unquestioning reliance on his promises. I never spent time on that one. That's a beautiful one. What do the word provisions mean here, by the way? Do you have any idea? As the best provision for their journey. That's another word which we could have chosen. It means, on the one hand, preparation to make provisions, but it also means, very concretely, food. Your provisions are the food you need to sustain you on your way. Okay? So what is it that is Our best provision? Very interesting. His promises are our best provision. That is what is going to sustain us. That is what is going to feed our souls. That is how we're going to be able to eat morning, night, our breakfasts, our lunches, and our dinners. We may be starving with our stomachs, but we are full fed with our souls because of his promises. Those are the best provisions that could take us on a very, very long journey. And no baggage claims. I mean, no overweight problems, I can assure you. Even those of you who've come with Ryanair can take his promises as the best provision of your journey and pay nothing for it. So to get back to that birthright, in this condition, with ourselves all prepared, we've set our faces to those fields and we've directed our steps to those goals. We are assured in our hearts that he who has led them to achieve such triumphs will continue to assist them in enriching their spiritual rights, enriching their spiritual birthright to a degree that no finite mind can imagine or human heart perceive. I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but my hunch is that the main emphasis of the word birthright there is in the direction of legacies. That heritage, which is a spiritual one that has been given to us. Because look at the word enriching. You know, most of us have read those wonderful stories which are a part of our wonderful European heritage. Once there was a king who had three sons. Do you remember those? And the first one did this, this, and this, and you know it's all wrong. And the second one did that, that, and that. He also wasted everything. But he had a third one. And the third one usually gets given nothing, you know, or a cat or something. And what does he do? He enriches his spiritual birthright. Invariably in these stories, it's the third one who manages not to waste what he's been given. This is one of those wonderful patterns of morality that gets given to us in our cultural heritage in Europe. So this question of enriching helps us understand what kind of birthright it is. I might just take a tiny little digression at this point. Tiny, tiny digression, just to define for the benefit of history and just to set the record straight that I may have been the only bambina, but there is a bambino in our particular family. And my brother is also alive and kicking and is also married to a great Baha'i dynasty and has three children, moreover. So the next time you get introduced to our family, this could go on, because the son of my brother is also married to another person who could also have children, and as a result of that, I mean, is this the birthright we're talking about? Those of you who were with me in the orientation day, do you remember what we read? That part of the beauty of this system is that it does not place any emphasis on privileges of birth. This is what is protecting this system from the evils inherent in previous systems. And I remember we were feeling about this, let us beware, even as we are proud of our dynasties, to distinguish between faith and family. Because as we know, a family can be absolutely wonderful and is the very basis and foundation of our society, but what gives it the spiritual birthright that it passes on is something spiritual to do with the faith of those individuals. And there are those of you who may have no birth connections of any distinction whatsoever, and you have a spiritual birthright that is infinitely as great, just as great and infinitely more than some of us who can claim to have a blood connection with the Dawnbreakers. Because what you have done is recognize your spiritual birthright. And you're in the process of enriching that. so that what you have received, you will pass on, and the people you pass it on to may not necessarily be your children. They will be your spiritual children. They will be the ones that you teach the faith to. They're going to be the inheritors of your legacy. And each one of us could try to trace what our spiritual legacy is, and I could guarantee this could be quite an interesting exercise in the course of this week, to figure out how we became Baha'is. We became Baha'is because so-and-so had heard about the faith from so-and-so, who'd heard about the faith from so... Goodness me, before you know it, you're right bang in the 10-year crusade, and you've had a pioneer who has arisen in response to the summons of Shoghi Effendi, and that person in turn has been taught the faith by maybe May Maxwell. Indeed, very often May Maxwell, if it comes to the European continent. She's our spiritual birthright in Europe. She's the one who gave us that spiritual legacy. It's not who our blood parents are and grandparents. It's not they who give us that sense of importance about our legacies. It's the spiritual birthright that we've all inherited equally. And what we're being called upon here to do is to enrich it. In other words, at the end of our lives, when we stand before his mercy seat and come to a reckoning, what he's going to want to know is, okay, what did you do with all that I gave you? What did you do with your thimbleful or your bucketful or your oceanful? Did it come to anything? Did you just give back to him only half of what you received? Three quarters maybe? Or did you double it, triple it, so that it's multiplied? And the world has been affected by the spiritual birthright from one individual. So I think that that word there, that spiritual birthright that we come to at the end of the sentence, is really the most extraordinary way in which we can feel intimately connected to the covenant. Each one of us is a spiritual inheritor, and therefore each one of us is being summoned to be a hero, and therefore each one of us is capable of putting on that armor and buckling on that shield of the covenant, capable of defending him, mounting on the steed of his steadfastness and stopping talking. Is that right? I think I've probably come to the end in any case. I don't have very much more to say. No, I shouldn't stop. No. Well, maybe the only thing we can really end in with is that point of infinity at the very, very last phrase. Look at it. In enriching their spiritual birthright, it's nice to kind of come to the point where you say, okay, how much? When Mr. Nashavani was saying, we will be called to a reckoning and asked to produce 70 people that we've taught the faith to, you know, I found myself thinking, well, you know, that's another way of thinking business is business. 70. Oh, that's enough. I only need to do it one person a year, and that'll do me. I don't need to have any more. But I mean, the ludicrousness of numbers here is something I think we all are aware of. But the way Shoghi Effendi ends this sentence is to remind us that the degree to which we can enrich our birthright, it is to a degree that no finite mind can imagine or human heart perceive. That's a promise. Remember, it began with the word assured. We can be assured that he who has led us, etc., will continue to assist us in enriching. We cannot do it alone. This process of enriching is not something we can do alone. But we can be assured that if he has led us in the past to achieve such triumphs, he will continue to assist us in the future to do likewise. And that is what will enrich our spiritual birthright to a degree that no finite mind can imagine. The horizon just dwindles away. You begin to see it's necessary to remind ourselves of that. All we can reasonably venture to attempt. But in fact, the sentence that I really wanted you to remember from last year, those of you that were with me, with us here, and those of you that were not, could just take a quick look at the sentence which begins on the second page of the three-page thing I gave you, because this sentence of today is directed to us as heroes. And that sentence from last year would maybe help us understand what kind of heroes. Do you remember that lovely sentence? The heroes whose deeds shine upon the record of this fierce spiritual conquest. Do you remember that? Were the Bab's chosen disciples. And I think this is where that spiritual birthright is. It's those of us who recognize that we are the heroes like those chosen disciples. That is the legacy he has given us in this cause, to be among those disciples and their companions. I don't want to take up your time reading it again, but I would recall to you those beautiful words that we had, who to so much this opposed that. Do you remember? And that is in itself a reminder of the sentence of yesterday. Integration, disintegration. Who opposed intrigue, ignorance, depravity, cruelty, superstition, and cowardice, who opposed that with a spirit, a knowledge, an eloquence. This is also part of the balancing in this faith, and the balancing that we saw in the sentence last year. And if you think about how you can sit on a horse, which is what I can't do, it really does require a tremendous amount of equilibrium, which is what we tried to learn about yesterday. And tomorrow we'll continue Heroes in Equilibrium. Let's see where we go from there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bahia June. You have really a special talent. And thank you that you share all these talents with us. And it's really very difficult to say announcement after all these precious explanations. But the committee asked me to repeat. Where are the seminars? Because somebody of you arrived yesterday after the division of the seminar. So, the yellow one is in the main hall, orange one is the main hall, white one is in this library, the blue one is in dining room, the purple in the TV room, the violet is in terrace, and turquoise, pink, and green, there are upstairs in the third floor. And, also it's written on the paper here, please. And the box of funds, we put in the entrance near the books because it's more private space, so... Okay, so you go after lunchtime, you go directly at 2 o'clock in your seminars, and we will see you here at 4 o'clock. Thank you so much.